Hi, this is Lita, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the today's issue of the New York Times. On the front page, a lot of blood. Witnesses describe the Charlie Kirk shooting. Andrew Piscaldo was standing in the middle of a campus amphitheater on Wednesday, waiting to debate Charlie Kirk about the Eighth Amendment when a single shot rang out. It was surprising, and no one really got down until the people in front of the stage did, he said. He was 28 years old with Salt Lake City. People got down in waves. He had been in line at a campus event at Utah Valley University, waiting to speak to and debate Mr. Kirk, as students typically do and prove me wrong, debates that Mr. Kirk, a right-wing activist, would host. Mr. Piscadlo, who estimated that he was about 80 feet away, recalled that Mr. Kirk had been responding to a question about transgender mass shooting suspects before he was shot. When the shot rang out, Mr. Piscadlo said that he dropped first but did not run. He said he did not see Mr. Kirk get shot. He estimated that the shooting occurred shortly after the program began, shortly after noon local time. Brandon Russin, a 24-year-old student in Ensign College in Salt Lake City, said he was near the front row of the crowd, about 20 feet from Mr. Kirk. I just saw Charlie kind of slump backwards, and I saw it was very graphic. I saw a lot of blood. And then everybody around me just fell to the ground trying to take cover, Mr. Russin said. He described the split second of confusion. Mr. Kirk was being asked about mass shootings at the time, and for a brief moment, Mr. Russin wondered whether the shooting was part of an act. That lasted only about a second before I realized it was something very serious going on, he said. Fearing that more shots could be fired, Mr. Russin said he stayed crouched on the ground for about a minute as people screamed and ran around him. He said that he texted his wife to tell her what was happening and that he loved her, then grabbed his friend who was next to him and ran for a nearby building. Mr. Russin said he was still shaken up by the event and felt grateful to be alive. He recalled that before it started, he had turned to his friend and said the courtyard venue was not ideal for someone who was a divisive public figure. Mr. Piscaldo said that the setup of the amphitheater struck him as unsafe before the event. Despite a heavy security presence, he noticed there were a lot of ledges, points where this could happen, he said. This seemed really preventable. I'm kind of angry at the organizers. Zachary Morris, who attended the event with his 3-year-old daughter, described confusion and a mass panic in the crowd when the shot was fired. I reached down and grabbed my daughter and my phone and began to run, said Mr. Morris, a registered nurse who lives in Lehi, Utah. He took cover in the Sorenson Student Center, but there people were yelling for everyone to evacuate the building. All I could think was that I got to get my daughter out of there, said Mr. Morris, who eventually exited safely with his daughter. Isaac Davis, a junior at Utah Valley University, said the shot fired wasn't that loud. He added it was definitely noticeable, but it sounded almost like a firecracker. He said he believed the shooter was not in the crowd. Mr. Davis said the scene devolved into hysteria after the shot, and he and several others were pushed indoors and into a classroom to hide. I just didn't want to be in the building while everything was going on, so I ran out of it, he said. And just a correction, I'm actually reading the September 10th issue, not today. Continuing on the front page, Mom Donnie reflects on life after 9/11 as a Muslim in New York City. It was the second day of classes at the Bank Street School for Children in Manhattan when the planes hit the World Trade Center. Zohran Mamdani can recall his father picking him up early to walk him home, the streets in a state of unease. He was 9 years old at the time, having moved to New York City 2 years earlier from South Africa. His memories of the attack and the days that followed have grown hazy with time, but he can clearly remember what it was like growing up in the aftermath, in a city transformed by tragedy and the Islamophobia that lingered. It became a fact of life, Mr. Mamdani said. He is the Democratic mayoral nominee. It was this horrific day that was also, for many New Yorkers, the moment at which they were marked as other. Now, 24 years later, Mr. Mamdani is on the precipice of becoming the city's first Muslim mayor, a potential milestone for the hundreds of thousands of Muslims who live here, and a signpost of broader acceptance, even as Mr. Mamdani has faced attacks because of his faith. After a recent prayer service at the Islamic Center at New York University, Amani Al-Khattabi, who's 33, an author and entrepreneur, said that Mr. Mamdani reflects the hopes of younger generations. We are facing the height of Islamophobia today, but at the same time, we're witnessing an unprecedented popularity with this brown Muslim candidate for the country's biggest city, she said. Ms. Al-Khattabi, whose family is of Palestinian and Jordanian descent, wrote a book about growing up in New Jersey after the September 11th attacks and the discrimination she and other Muslim Americans faced in their wake. It feels like now that Muslim 9/11 kids are having the moment where we can show that this city is our home and that we belong here, she said. The September 11th attacks were a formative experience for Mr. Mamdani and a common topic of discussion in his home. His mother, Mira Nair, an Oscar-nominated filmmaker, directed a short film in 2002 about Muhammad Salman Hamdani, a Muslim man who died in the attacks. Several years later, Mr. Mamdani's father, Mahum Mamdani, a professor at Columbia University, published a book called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim that explored the factors that led to the attack. Mr. Mamdani has said in a handful of interviews that his teacher at Bank Street told him on September 11th that something had happened that morning and warned him that he might be bullied. The teacher told the New York Times that while she did not recall that specific conversation, the class likely discussed ways to make sure students felt supported and safe in the days and weeks following the attacks. Mr. Mamdani plans to attend the September 11th commemoration in Lower Manhattan on Thursday, along with other elected officials. He said he would be thinking of the victims and their families. The first thing is to honor the memories of those that were killed, he said. He described learning their stories over the many years that I've been a New Yorker, the deep sorrow that continues to this day, of futures that were stolen from so many and families that continue to live with that. Though Mr. Mamdani has reached out energetically to Muslim New Yorkers, he has not foregrounded his identity in his campaign, which has focused chiefly on affordability. Imam Khalid Latif, the executive director of the Islamic Center of New York City and a friend of Mr. Mamdani's, said that it was affirming to see so many New Yorkers embrace him. He's showing people who we are by showing who he is. He is running on principle, on ethics, on values, he said. He is speaking to individuals from diverse backgrounds, and his religion is a part of that identity and informs his sense of the collective and common good. The imam's sense of pride was mixed with some unease. He said he remembered the racial profiling, police surveillance, and hate crimes against Muslims that took place after the 11th of September. He said he was not surprised about the backlash Mr. Mamdani has faced because of his religion. Indeed, Mr. Mamdani has weathered a slew of attacks, included from the president and from his leading campaign rival, former Governor Andrew Cuomo. Mr. Cuomo, whom Mr. Mamdani defeated in the primary and who is running again in the general election, has called Mr. Mamdani a terrorist sympathizer over his criticism of Israel. He held a news conference on Tuesday near Ground Zero alongside an emergency worker who responded to the attack to try to link Mr. Mamdani to Hassan Piker, a popular Twitch and YouTube streamer who once said America deserved 9/11. Mr. Mamdani appeared on Mr. Piker's show in April. Rich Azapardi, a spokesman for the Cuomo campaign, said the attacks had nothing to do with religion, and that instead of answering questions about his past statements, Mr. Mamdani literally runs away from reporters and New Yorkers demanding answers. Mr. Mamdani called Mr. Cuomo's tactics disgusting and an example of the exact kind of politics that New Yorkers are sick of. To weaponize one of the darkest days in our city's history to stoke Islamophobia and score cheap political points is beneath the dignity of New Yorkers, he said. Other attacks have come from President Trump and his allies in Congress, who have questioned whether Mr. Mamdani was in the country legally and have threatened to arrest him or deport him. Mr. Mamdani, a state assemblyman who represents a district in Queens, was born in Uganda to parents of Indian descent and moved to New York in 1999 and became a U.S. citizen in 2018. Laura Loomer, an advisor to the president, posted on social media on primary night that there would be another 9/11 in New York City, and Mr. Mamdani will be to blame. The actress Deborah Messing wrote on social media that she would not vote for Mr. Mamdani because he celebrated 9/11. In fact, Mr. Mamdani has expressed sadness over the September 11th attacks, and in the final days of the primary campaign, he tearfully recounted death threats he and his family had received, as well as a message that said, "The only good Muslim is a dead Muslim." Imam Lateef recalled a primary campaign effort by a group supporting Mr. Cuomo to alter a photo of Mr. Mamdani to make his beard look darker and thicker. "They can darken his beard as much as they want," Imam Lateef said. "It shows how feeble their attempts were to cast this fear-based narrative upon him." The city has a significant Muslim population centered in neighborhoods including Bay Bridge in Brooklyn and Jackson Heights in Queens, which Mr. Mamdani won during the primary. Mr. Mamdani's victory was fueled in part by many voters from those communities who did not regularly turn out in elections, and many of the Muslims who voted for him said they were drawn by his platform, including Sidra Tufail, 41 of the Upper West Side, who works in supply chain management. Ms. Tufail, who grew up in Pakistan and lived in several countries before moving to Manhattan, described New York as an anomaly. "It's so diverse here. It's such an international community. There's so many different backgrounds," she said. "I think the facts is such an inclusive place is helping him." Omar Khan, 33, who works in information technology and lives in downtown Brooklyn, said he anticipates that Mr. Mamdani's success would inspire other Muslims, New Yorkers, to engage more in civic life. "Just because you're a Muslim or belong to a certain religion doesn't mean that you shouldn't get involved, right?" he said. "You should absolutely get involved." Continuing from the front page, Gulf powers question U.S. protection after Israeli attack on Qatari soil. Qatar hosts the largest American military base in the Middle East, has bought billions of dollars worth of defense systems from the United States, and recently gifted a luxury Boeing jet to President Trump. Yet on Tuesday, none of that stopped Israel, a key U.S. ally, from launching a brazen military attack on Qatari soil. It was an attempt to assassinate senior Hamas officials who had gathered to discuss a ceasefire proposal to pause the war in Gaza, a deal that was backed by Trump. Qatar, being unable to protect its own citizens with literally the U.S. Central Command on its territory, has prompted locals to question the value of the American partnership, said Kristen Dewan, a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf State Institute in Washington, a research group. "It's a real problem for Gulf leaders, and it should worry the United States as well." The Israeli attack sent shockwaves through Gulf capitals that have been courted by Israel as potential allies in recent years and have long regarded the U.S. as their main security guarantor. The strike hit a residential neighborhood in the Qatari capital of Doha, sending black smoke into the sky and killing a member of Qatar's internal security forces, Badr Saad al-Humadi al-Dorsari, according to Qatari officials. He became the first Gulf Arab to be killed by Israel in decades. Qatar has agreed to host the political leadership of Hamas at the behest of the United States, positioning the country as a critical mediator in talks to end the war in Gaza. In a statement, the Palestinian Armed Group confirmed the son of Khalil al-Haya, Hamas's chief negotiator, and four other people affiliated with Hamas were killed in the attack. It is not yet clear how the Israeli strike will affect ceasefire negotiations, which were already stalled. Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, Qatar's prime minister, said on Tuesday that nothing will deter his country from playing its role as mediator, even as he accused Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel of trying to sabotage every attempt to create opportunities for peace. Israel's attack will reverberate far beyond, Qatar analysts say. The country's willingness to launch an attack in a Gulf state marks a potential turning point for the region, which has long been dominated by American alliances and interests. This is a litmus test, said Badr al-Saif, an assistant professor of history at Kuwait University. If Gulf rulers don't do anything forceful now, they will only be part of an Israeli orbit of power in Israeli-led regional order. The fossil fuel-rich Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Oman, Kuwait, and Bahrain, have become increasingly ambitious in recent years, using their vast wealth to garner influence around the world. Combined, the countries control roughly $4 trillion of assets in their sovereign wealth funds, and several of them have substantial sway over the global energy market. Their domestic agendas hinge on their reputation as safe havens for trade, investment, and tourism in a volatile Middle East, a reputation Israel's attacks struck at directly. Netanyahu himself declared that he will reshape the Middle East, Sheikh Mohammed said on Tuesday. Is this a message that we also intend to reshape the Gulf? A military response by Gulf countries is out of the question because further escalation would harm the domestic agendas of the Gulf rulers. And despite frustration with U.S. policy in the region, they remain dependent on American military support. But they have a lot of tools at their disposal, Mr. al-Saif said, including diplomacy and economic leverage. If Gulf sovereign funds decided to take action through divestment that hurts Israeli-affiliated or American-affiliated interests, that could have an impact, he argued. How Gulf countries will respond is not yet clear. It is a question that will be addressed at an Arab-Islamic summit to be held in Doha in the coming days, Sheikh Mohammed said. There is a collective response that should happen from the region, he said, and we are hoping for something meaningful that deters Israel. What is clear, though, is that they are, once again, questioning the utility of American security guarantees, this time just months after Mr. Trump toured the region, singing its rulers' praises and signing a flurry of business deals. The United States called Qatar to warn about the attack 10 minutes after it had already happened, Sheikh Mohammed said. It's difficult for the U.S. to deliver to us at this stage, Mr. al-Saif said, referring collectively to the Gulf countries. We need to come up with another alternative, or we need to come together with Mr. Trump again and talk security purely and not just have a commercial blitz. The attack is also likely to undermine Mr. Trump's hopes to expand the Abraham Accords, a series of U.S. broker deals in 2020 that saw the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain establish diplomatic ties with Israel, agreements that the president viewed as one of the crowning foreign policy achievements of his first term. Qatar was not part of the Accords and has had tensions with some of its Gulf neighbors. But the attack on Tuesday united the Gulf countries in condemnation of Israel and stirred mutual fears about their vulnerability. Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, the Emirati ruler, traveled to Qatar for a state visit on Wednesday with his powerful national security advisor, Sheikh Tamim bin Zayed. U.S. partners and U.S. policymakers themselves are coming to the late realization that Israel's militant mindset is a threat to the entire region, said Joseph Farsakh, a former U.S. State Department official focused on the Arabian Peninsula. In the long term, Mr. Farsakh said the Gulf will realize that working with Israel is simply bad for business. And just a reminder, you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Continuing in Section A, local sheriffs are turning their jails into ICE detention centers. Vans carrying immigrants arrive at Ohio's Butler County Jail, about an hour north of Cincinnati, throughout the day and night. They come from across the state, from Illinois, Michigan, and even Arizona. Some detainees will spend a few nights here, others weeks as they wait to be deported. Immigrant detainees are not new to Butler County. Except for a hiatus during the Biden years, the sheriff has held a contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement to use space in his jail for nearly two decades. But now they fill nearly half of the jail's 860 beds. Butler is among the largest of a growing number of county jails and other local facilities that now house a sizable chunk of ICE detainees, many of whom have never been charged with a crime. The agency's use of these facilities has more than doubled since President Trump took office, and jails held about 10% of all detainees, or 7,100 people on average, each day in July. With detention numbers at a record high, jails have proven to be a quick and convenient way for ICE to expand its detention capacity beyond existing federal and private facilities. Many sheriffs are eager to assist in Mr. Trump's mass deportation plans and to shore up their budgets by offering up their beds. "We're essential," said Jonathan Thompson, the executive director and chief executive of the National Sheriffs Association. "ICE can't do what they do under the current circumstances without sheriffs in our jails." Jails are often the first stop on the way to somewhere else in ICE's vast detention network, and they fill a geographic hole for ICE in the Midwest in particular, where there are few detention centers. At most jails, ICE can easily spin up a contract through existing partnerships to hold federal inmates with the U.S. Marshals Services, reducing the time it takes to approve a new facility. County jails do not have to provide immigrants the same level of legal and medical services as those offered in dedicated ICE facilities, and the bed space is usually less expensive, too. This year, the agency has inked new detention contracts with jails in both rural counties and urban areas. Most of the sheriff's signings are up in red states or from the Republican-led areas of blue states, like Nassau County in New York. But the agency also holds large contracts for detention space at jails in Democratic-led states, including Massachusetts, Minnesota, and Vermont. Norman Chaffins, the sheriff in Grayson County, Kentucky, visited the White House during the first Trump administration to hear from leaders at ICE and Border Patrol. "That's where I first understood that even though we're not a border state, we're still feeling the effects of illegal immigrants right here in our own county." He said the jail now holds about 150 people each day for ICE. Legal groups and immigrant advocates say local jails are ill-equipped to house immigrants whose needs for legal language and medical services are often different from those of other inmates. Inspections at some local facilities have turned up violations of ICE standards: water leaking from ceilings into beds, no daily change of clean socks and underwear, though conditions at county jails can vary widely. During the Biden administration, ICE went as far as ending one jail contract in Alabama and pausing another in Florida, citing serious deficiencies and concerns about medical care. Under Mr. Trump, both facilities are once again holding hundreds of immigrants. A spokeswoman for the Department of Homeland Security said that both facilities were recently inspected. "If county jails are good enough to hold U.S. citizens, then they are sure good enough to hold illegal aliens," Tricia McLaughlin, an assistant secretary for the Department of Homeland Security, said in a statement. Jails have been part of the ICE detention system since the agency's creation. During the George Bush administration, ICE has contracted with around 350 jails, and about half of all immigrant detainees were held in local facilities. The detention model at the time was to seek out contracts with lots of jails for little bits of use, 5, 10, 20 beds. At the start of the Obama administration, the Department of Homeland Security overhauled its approach to detention and began to contract with dedicated facilities designed specifically for ICE, mostly by private prison operators. At the county jail's oversight was complicated, and there were concerns about mixing civil immigration detainees with criminal inmates, and bad things were happening, said Claire Trickler McNulty, a former ICE official who served in Republican and Democratic administrations. The thinking was, let's reduce the number of county jails and focus on building civil detentions. Under Mr. Trump, ICE is seeking both new and old ways to find space for the tens of thousands of people in its custody. The administration has reopened several private facilities that sat dormant, and it has struck deals in Indiana and Nebraska to use beds in their state prisons. And it has turned back to the county jails. All you sheriffs in the room, we need your bed space, Tom Homan, the so-called border czar, said at a National Sheriffs Association conference in February. A single county jail provides ICE with, at most, 500 beds a day, though many operate above their contracted capacity. In July, there were about 163 local facilities being used by ICE, and on average, they each held about 44 people a day. ICE doesn't have the capacity for what they're doing, said Bob Gualtieri, the sheriff in Pinellas County, Florida. He said that ICE needed more beds for longer stays, 60 to 90 days, which some jails can provide. You can deputize tons of local cops, but if the system doesn't have enough room, what are you doing? In many cases, the size of the jail is less important to the ICE strategy than its location. People arrested in nearby any state can be held locally until ICE can find space in one of its large private detention facilities clustered in the South. Since the start of Mr. Trump's crackdown, more than a third of all people arrested by ICE have been held in a local facility at some point. We have the largest jail infrastructure in the world, and it's an easy thing for ICE to fall back on, said Silky Shah, the executive director of the Detention Watch Network, an advocacy group that opposes immigration detention. The jail is a really central component of the deportation machine. Many sheriffs see the decision to partner with ICE as good policy. Most support tougher immigration restrictions, according to a 2022 survey, and good politics. Often, their constituents do too. There's an ideological role that's played where sheriffs are excited about participating in the deportation process and supporting President Trump's agenda, said Maria Holman, a professor of public policy at the University of Houston, who studies in the role of the sheriff's office. Inside Butler County Jail, Sheriff Richard Jones displays several photographs of Mr. Trump, including one of both men thumb-upping together after a campaign rally in Cincinnati in 2016, where the sheriff took the stage. Mr. Jones first signed on to accept ICE detainees in 2008, but canceled the jail's contract under President Joe Biden, in part because he didn't like the administration immigration policies. The jail was also facing a lawsuit brought by two immigrants who alleged they were beaten by guards. Mr. Jones said he got interested in helping ICE 20 years ago after an undocumented immigrant released from his jail went on to rape a 9-year-old girl. He feels his motivations line up with the administration's enforcement priorities, even as they have expanded to include people without a criminal record. His corrections staff members, he said, prefer to work in the cell block housing immigrants. They don't cause any trouble. They stay to themselves. They have tables they can play cards on, he said. My local homegrown prisoners want to fight all the time. ICE typically pays jails $70 to $110 per day per detainee, usually more than county's budget for local inmates. For some counties, that is a small but significant and reliable source of revenue. In Butler County, the total budget for the sheriff's office this year is $49 million, and the county expects to earn about $4 million from ICE. But at least some sheriffs say it's not worth it. We were making $1 million a year holding federal inmates, Joe Kennedy, the sheriff of Dubuque County, Iowa, said after an earlier contract with the federal government. He declined an invitation from ICE to offer detention space in his jail this year. The problem was, logistically, it was very difficult. You're responsible for moving the inmates, getting them to court hearings. We were running people all over, he said. We're not interested in putting our staff through that again. One of the chief criticisms of ICE's jail partnerships is that jails are meant for criminals, not civil detention. Most immigration violations are a civil offense, and about a third of people arrested by ICE this year had no criminal history. People hate private detention because they hate the profit motive, but the local jails are jail. They are carceral, punitive places, said Royce Murray, who was a senior DHS official in the Biden administration. In interviews, immigrants who spent time detained at county jails in Florida, Indiana, and Kentucky described what they said was cruel and unfair treatment by correction officers or staff, including taking away their mattresses and bedding or refusing to provide basic necessities like cups and spoons. One detainee said he would rinse out old potato chip bags in order to have something to drink water from. Unlike local inmates arrested on charges like drunk driving or drug possession, immigrant detainees are rarely given the option to bond out of jail. While most are transferred to bigger ICE facilities after 72 hours, in some cases they have spent weeks or months inside jails not designed for long-term stays. There was once an effort to make the rules governing ICE facilities consistent. Provisions like no less than 5 hours per day of access to law libraries for detainees and at least 1 hour per day of outdoor physical exercise. But the agency has loosened those requirements for some facilities over the years, including many jails. This year, there have been reports of overcrowded, unsanitary, and inhumane conditions at some of the local facilities ICE uses. Detainees at a state correction facility in Anchorage said they had been pepper sprayed and denied access to their lawyers at the Phelps County Jail in Rolla, Missouri, which signed its first ICE detention contract this year. A 27-year-old Colombian man died by suicide in April. As of this month, the jail will no longer accept new ICE detainees and will transfer existing ones, citing cost concerns. Federal officials declined to answer specific questions about these cases and said all jails used by ICE meet federal detention standards. Routine inspections are one component of ICE's multi-layered inspections and oversight process that ensures transparency in how facilities meet the threshold of care outlined in contracts with facilities, as well as ICE's national detention standards, Ms. McLaughlin, the DHS spokeswoman, said. On a visit in July, the Butler County Jail appeared clean and organized. It was not crowded. The jail holds about 90 people per cell block, or pod, with 2 people per cell. Male ICE detainees were held in a separate area of the jail from regular inmates, but the few women were mixed with the local population. Small televisions show Bounce TV played in the cells. But there was no library, no internet access, or computers. In the pod reporters visited in July, there was one cart of about 2 dozen books. The pods at the jail each have their own recreation area, a concrete basketball half court with a single window. Detainees are not allowed outside. Again, just a reminder, you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Moving over to the opinion page from the editorial section, Trump is treating the economy like his family business. This is submitted by the editorial board. More than 15 years ago, President Barack Obama decided that America's automakers were too important to die, and he used government money to save them. There is a plausible argument that Intel, the semiconductor company, falls into the same category. It is one of the few makers of computer chips in the United States. Other companies like NVIDIA design chips but rely primarily on Taiwanese factories to make them, which presents serious economic and national security vulnerabilities in the event of a war there. Government help for Intel and President Trump recently had the government take a stake in it, could help the company make a comeback, much as the Obama bailout did for the domestic auto industry. Unfortunately, Mr. Trump's approach will probably do nothing to help the company. It is one more way in which he is intervening in the American economy on a whim, as if it were an extension of his family business to the detriment of us all. Mr. Trump began his interaction with Intel on social media. He berated Intel's new chief executive, Lip-Bu Tan, for his business ties to China from previous jobs and demanded that he resign. Mr. Tan went to the Oval Office to save his job. During the meeting, Mr. Trump suggested that Intel give a 10% stake to the United States government. And Mr. Tan, under obvious duress, agreed. This is not how economic policy is supposed to work in a wealthy democratic country. When the president takes the extreme step of intervening in particular companies, he should articulate a strategy, as Mr. Obama did with the auto industry and as the domestic semiconductor industry today needs. He should follow and respect the law. Instead, Mr. Trump's approach to Intel reads like something out of Venezuela or Russia, where political leaders use threats and insults to cow businesses' executives into submission. Mr. Trump has repeatedly blasted through American norms and laws in pursuit of his economic policies. He allowed NVIDIA and AMD to sell chips to China on the highly unusual condition that the companies give the government a cut of the revenue. He enacted tariffs on other countries, effectively raising taxes on Americans without congressional approval, in a move that courts have since deemed illegal. He has used the threat of those tariffs to compel companies like Apple and foreign governments to promise more investment in the United States. He has broken a century of precedent by trying to fire a governor of the Federal Reserve, the country's independent central bank, based on unproven charges. If a Democratic president pursued even one of these policies, Republicans would call him a meddling socialist. Sometimes Mr. Trump's moves have apparently benefited, such as modest amounts of new domestic investment. But what differentiates a democracy from an autocracy is the process that leads to an outcome. A fair legal process both protects citizens' rights and tends to be better for the economy in the long run. The dollar, for example, has become the world's reserve currency because of America's stability. Investors can trust the United States to follow the law, respect previous agreements, and pay its debts. Mr. Trump has undermined that faith. Countries like Spain and India are pursuing closer trading ties to China, an American adversary, because they no longer see the U.S. as reliable. Any short-term wins for Mr. Trump, bullying comes at a cost to the country's long-term prosperity, as well as its global goodwill and trustworthiness. Not even the short-term results look good. Economic growth and job growth have slowed since he took office in January. The semiconductor industry may well need government help. The United States cannot rely on Taiwan, as it now does for the building blocks of the computers that power our economy and our military. The Biden administration, working with congressional Republicans, took some valuable steps. A bipartisan 2022 law that subsidized domestic chip production has led to increased investment. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, which makes NVIDIA chips, is using the subsidies from the law to build plants in Arizona, and Intel is similarly building plants in Ohio. But it remains unclear whether these steps are sufficient to put this country on a path to build a sufficient number of cutting-edge chips. Mr. Trump's intervention does not help. The stake that he took in Intel does not even give it additional money. He instead intimidated the company into giving the federal government partial ownership in exchange for the subsidies it already received from the 2022 law. His complaint about that law was that it did not set tough enough terms, which is a narrow and unwise way to look at a federal investment in a vital industry. It is not how federal dollars help create Silicon Valley, as well as the pharmaceutical, aviation, and fracking industries. Those successes depended on patience and sober governance. The investments helped build confidence among potential customers and employees. Ultimately, the success of an industry that the government is trying to help matters far more than any benefit Washington may receive from owning a stake in a company. Mr. Trump evidently believes that his haphazard, self-centered approach to policy makes him look tough and decisive. In reality, it introduces more chaos to our economy, including to an industry at the center of 21st century life. In an opinion piece from John McWhorter, my daughter's slang taught me something cool about how language evolves. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, there was a lot of talk about the generation gap. The gap was understood to be a matter of culture and values, but the reality is that much of it was just about language. Sitcoms and comic books were full of grown-ups thrown by teen slang, exasperatingly asking for translations. I assumed it was all just overreaction. Surely there's always some way to work out what new use of words means. I'm learning lately that sometimes there isn't. I have spent the summer in my Catskills bungalow hideaway listening day in and day out to tweens, my daughters and their friends, talking. I have so often had to ask them what their slang means that one of my daughters started teasingly called me Pops, as if I were a character in an Archie comic. It was humbling, but actually I enjoyed it because it gave me a front row view on the processes by which language morphs along from, say, Beowulf to Baywatch, one shift at a time. Take the word eat. In some languages of the West African coast, believe it or not, eat can mean to become something. In a language like Tiwali in Ghana, one way to say I became the captain is I came and ate captain, with the sense perhaps of taking in, ingesting, a role. Because this is generally an unwritten language, there was no way to trace through documents how this usage evolved. I considered it the most creative, extended usage of eat in any language I had ever encountered until the kids started using eat in a similarly diagonal way. The first time I heard it, one Gen Zer had just performed a song. "Girl, you ate it," her friend said. "Ate what?" I asked. They explained what many readers may already know, that eat means do something really well. To put a sharper point on it, you can say she totally devoured that outfit. It reminds me of what a stretch the word use gets in used to. In ordinary, as a sentence like, "We used to go every year," sounds that usage of use is, if you think about it, quite odd. We utilized to go every year. She ate that test would have sounded just as crazy to someone in George Washington's day, or to me, until about 3 months ago. I also had to squint, metaphorically speaking, to know what the tween meant this summer by "you clocked her tea." Tea began years ago as black gay or drag slang, referring to gossip that you spill, potentially accompanied by holding up the thumb and middle finger as if holding a cup of tea. But the tweens I know are unaware of that history. Regardless, they still make that teacup gesture, a tradition that is as meaningless to them as throwing rice at a bride. Because I surmise clock can also sound like you deep-sixed someone or cleaned their clock, they use the expression to refer to winning an argument. As for the T, they hear the word is simply the 20th letter of the alphabet. So random and yet so normal. Letters tend to generate expressions. Okay, started in Jacksonian America with a jolly journalistic misspelling of all correct as O-L-L-K-O-R-R-E-C-T. That was abbreviated as OK. Became a journalistic in-joke, percolated outward into general expression, and is now used worldwide. Think also of on the QT from quiet. Hey, and then there's chat. People were saying hey as far back as early Middle English, as in H-E-I, H-W-U-C-H, whiz red, or hey, what wise counsel, a line from the legend of St. Catherine of Alexandria. No one knows how it first happened, but among theories on the origins of yo, I find most likely the one tracing it to immigrants who spoke the Naples dialect of Italian, in which the word for young man is Guglione, pronounced Guoglione. Whoa. Now, as I first hear from some of my students last fall, there is chat, of which this summer I have gotten an earful and then some. The kids used it at least once a minute. Chat. We should do this every year. Chat. I'm sorry. Using this glitter wasn't a good idea. Is it ever? Supposedly, this started with people addressing the chat section of online platforms such as Twitch. Then people started using the word in spoken group conversation as a form of collective address. Now, the meaning has generalized into a way to call attention, something akin to listen, everybody, or more demotically, folks, or you guys. Most terms the internet lends us are concrete things like names, nouns, and actions, like gamers, quote, PWN, end quote, a variant typing of own, O-U-N, in the sense of outdo, and hit refresh. Chat is different. Not a thing or a process, but a word used to get attention. This is the internet truly penetrating language, reaching the pragmatics in the sense I discussed last week. Verbal gestures to convey attitude, indicate shared experience, or mark something as novel. I have especially enjoyed watching the birth of a term of tribal affection. My daughter's BFF was vastly amused for reasons beyond me by a meme of a rather corpulent cat eyeing a fast food delivery through a glass door with the caption, "Chill out, Biggie, it's not for you." She and the others started using Biggie to refer to one another. Back in June, this was meant mockingly with reference to matters of eating and size. By August, it had softened into a kind of joshing tribal label like dude. They use it to chide without antagonism. Biggie, you took my seltzer. They use it in praise. You did it, you Biggie. And it has more bungalow pragmatics. I've even heard them use it to mean some guy. They say of a figure in a video game. Biggie ran around the corner. Social bonding terms often begin in this way with a concrete definition, wearing down into less literal but perhaps more powerful marks of belonging. Dude first referred to a male fancy dresser, a dandy likely derived from Yankee Doodle. Today, it means roughly the same thing as yo. No Brits singing Yankee Doodle 2.5 centuries ago could have imagined that one day a shortened version of doodle would become common coin across American descendants of enslaved African people. They would be further stunned that after a while it came to be used among women of every race to signal gender-neutral fellowship. The meaning has drifted as far as my tween's Biggie has from a hungry cat. This is why linguists just describe rather than judge. At any given time, no one can know which parts of the language will end up drifting into fascinating new directions. Every language and every dialect of every language is vibrating with potential. And let's just ask this question. Who doesn't love Prince Harry? Prince Harry is reunites with King Charles for the first time in over a year. Prince Harry met with his father, King Charles III, in London on Wednesday in what appeared to be the first step toward healing a rift that has sundered the British royal family since the prince and his American-born wife, Meghan, withdrew from royal duties and moved to the United States in 2020. As car carrying Harry 40 was seen entering Clarence House, the King's London residence, at 5:20 p.m. on a rain-swept afternoon. Charles and his wife, Queen Camilla, had been staying in Balmoral Castle in Scotland earlier in the week, but returned to London, where the King also presided over an investiture ceremony at Clarence House on Wednesday, according to Buckingham Palace. Harry's office did not immediately comment on the meeting, the possibility of which has tantalized royal watchers since the prince arrived in Britain for a four-day visit on Monday. But a palace official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said father and son had shared a private tea at Clarence House. The BBC reported that the session had lasted 55 minutes, somewhat longer than the 30 minutes that Harry spent with Charles in February of 2024. The King also attended a meeting on Wednesday of his Privy Council, a group of advisors to the monarch, and granted an audience to the Premier of the State of South Australia, Peter Malinauskas. Charles and Camilla planned to return to Scotland on Thursday, the official said. The king's busy schedule appeared calculated to show that he had not made the trip from Scotland solely to see Harry. Charles bestowed an honor, member of the Order of the British Empire, on Manfred Goldberg, a German-born British survivor of the Holocaust who had been prominent in Holocaust education and remembrance. Last May, Harry expressed hope for a reconciliation with his father, whom he had not seen since shortly after Charles, 76, was diagnosed with an undisclosed form of cancer. In an emotional interview with the BBC, Harry said, "I don't know how much longer my dad has." The atmospherics for a reconciliation seemed poor. The palace was annoyed that Harry had raised doubts about the king's prognosis, palace officials insisting he is improving, though he still receives weekly cancer treatment. Harry also antagonized his father by suggesting that Charles should have intervened in his lawsuit against Britain's Home Office for withdrawing automatic police protection for him and his family after he and Meghan left Britain. A high court in London ruled against Harry, and he lost an appeal in May. Harry has had a packed schedule of meetings and events involving various charities and philanthropies this week, but the latter part of his itinerary in London left room for a meeting with Charles. There was no indication that Harry had met with his older brother, Prince William, from whom he is also estranged. Some royal commentators had noted that the family quarrel, if left unresolved, could undermine the public's idea of what the monarchy stands for. After Harry's public plea for reconciliation, Peter Hunt, a former royal correspondent at the BBC, told the New York Times that the king represents an institution that is about family, unity, and fostering forgiveness. His role is to bring people together. And in a new TV drama, Mussolini wants to make Italy great again. In the first episode of Mussolini, Son of the Century, streaming on MUBI in the United States starting Wednesday, Luca Marinelli, the actor who plays the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, turns to the camera and, breaking the fourth wall, extols the virtue of fascism. His movement, he says, will conquer millions of hearts. Yours too, I am sure. Follow me, and you too will love me. You will also become fascist. So begins a gripping 8-episode ride, one taken by Italians a century ago, to see what happens when democracy crumbles, and how quickly it can happen. Mapping Mussolini's meteoric rise from leader of a ragtag movement to disaffected young men to total control of the state in a mere 6 years, the series comes across as a primer for authoritarianism. It underscores how violence is central to that cause and how easy it can be to identify with a charismatic leader. Luca had to transform himself into a Mussolini, who wasn't simply depicted as a monster, but as a man who wanted to seduce all at all costs, said Lorenzo Meli, a producer of the series. That included not just his population, but also the spectators, hence the follow me phrase. Son of the Century is based on the first of 5 historical novels chronicling Mussolini, written by Antonio Scarati. The books were chosen, Meli said, because they were based on primary sources and explained how Mussolini, quote, "while creating fascism, invented populism," end quote, in Italy, and populism is, quote, "something that is really relevant today," end quote, he added. Scarati said in an interview that his generation has lived this illusion that democracy was a given, a natural fact like a forest. But he added, that's not the case. Democracy was and is precarious and fragile, the result of past battles. That's something that should never be forgotten, he said, all the more so today when liberal democracy is again in danger almost at every latitude. Joe Wright, the series director, said in an interview that he had been shocked by the number of blatant parallels between current far-right populist leaders and Mussolini, but decided not to weigh down the series by weighing overly didactic, trusting that the audience would connect those dots on their own. But, he said, he couldn't resist making one very direct reference to a particular politician in the 4th episode when Mussolini gives a thumbs up to the camera and says, "Make Italy great again." As history shows, Mussolini's story wasn't so great in the end, nor was Italy's. But Wright pointed out how quickly, with the passing of generations, people forget the lessons learned, and I guess maybe have to relearn those lessons all over again. Though Italy's 1920s were faithfully recreated for the show in various studios in Cinecittà and Rome, the tone is deliberately modern. During a set visit in 2023, Wright, who also directed the movie Atonement and a 2005 adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, described the aesthetic for Mussolini, Son of the Century, as a kind of mashup between the 90s rave culture and experimental Soviet documentary film, Man with the Movie Camera, and every gangster's movie you've ever seen. Underscored by a pulsing techno soundtrack by Tom Rollins of the Chemical Brothers, the series is driven by a raw energy that builds momentum with Mussolini's violence-driven rise. The series premiered at the Venice Film Festival last year and aired in Italy and other European countries earlier this year, but it struggled to find a distributor in the United States. Selling the show, finding a U.S. distributor was not easy, and I think that's because of the political content of the show, Wright said. He said he's been told by one very, very high-profile streaming executive that even though they loved the show, it was too controversial to put on their platform. My question back was, since when did anti-fascism become controversial? The series ends with the famous speech by Mussolini in Parliament, a pivotal moment that led to the beginning of nearly two decades of dictatorship. But whether viewers will get to see what happens next is up in the air. Because the show struggled to find a market outside Europe, there are no concrete plans for a second season, the producer said. Politics and controversies aside, he said the fact that the series was a period piece, acted in Italian with subtitles, had made it a harder sell. But he added that he and Wright were very much on board if funding came through, so a second season can't be ruled out. Having chronicled Winston Churchill's agonizing first months as Prime Minister during World War II and the 2017 film Darkest Hour, Wright said he was keen to tackle the era from another viewpoint. Hitler started out as a fanboy of Mussolini's and then overtook him, he said. Obviously, I think that's a fascinating period, and what I would dearly love to look at it in more detail. And that's it for me. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 11th issue of the New York Times. Your reader is Lita. Thanks for listening. Take care, and as always, keep smiling.